Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
On today's episode, episode number 220, entitled, How to Overcome Addiction, Anxiety, and Depression and Live Life Without Fear, I chat with Sam Morris. Sam Morris is a recovery coach and addiction consultant, and in today's episode, Sam talks about his story of suffering from addiction for a number of years, hitting rock bottom, and finally pulling himself out of his deepest, darkest hole. He covers a myriad of fascinating topics while sharing his redemption story, including battling his inner demons and overcoming severe anxiety and depression. Sam covers the steps he took to take his life back and beat his horrible addiction to both alcohol and cocaine, and what he learned on his journey in regard to self-discovery and empowerment. If you're wondering how you or someone you love can beat addiction, anxiety, or depression too, and take back their own lives, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Hey, have you checked out our Elite Man YouTube channel yet? If not, get on it right now. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube and start watching our fantastic videos. We cover everything from dating, health, business, fitness, confidence, mindset, social skills, everything that you need to know to be a 21st century elite man. We've got you covered. We have a new video coming out every Monday and Friday, and I'm telling you, this is the number one place to get your elite man fix and the number one place to grow as a man. These videos will absolutely change your life and entertain you at the same time. I'm telling you, check these videos out right now. I have so much fun putting them together, and I know you're going to absolutely love them. elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube. Make sure you check it out right now and subscribe to our channel to get more of these fantastic videos and get notified the instant we release a new video. elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube. If you haven't joined our Elite Man newsletter yet, you are missing out. Get on it right now. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and sign up to get special Elite Man content not seen nor heard anywhere else. Get all of our bonus podcast information, sneak peeks, and upcoming shows, behind-the-scenes content, special offers, and exclusive Elite Man updates you won't find anywhere else. I'm telling you, if you're not on our newsletter, you are missing out. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and become a true member of the Elite Man community. I look forward to speaking to you soon. elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from ElitemanMagazine.com, and my guest today is Sam Morris, the addiction recovery coach. Sam, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
It's my pleasure, Justin. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. We got a mutual friend, Craig Ballantyne, that recommended you come on the show, and yeah, I'm excited to have you on. I'm really excited to pick your brain because I know you've overcome a lot of personal issues in your life, including addiction and also anxiety and depression, which has personally in my life been a huge thing that I overcame. I'm just kind of curious, what was the thing that you were addicted to in the past?
The addiction was mainly alcohol and cocaine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I experimented with a lot of other drugs like marijuana and, you know, some psychedelics and stuff like that, ecstasy. But at the bitter end, it was the alcohol and the cocaine that stuck around and brought me down.
And so how long were you addicted to that for?
Well, you know, addiction's funny because like I can kind of there's kind of two ways to look at that. There's one is when I started to feel the consequences of it and then started to kind of fight back in the addiction. But if I look back, really, to be honest, like there was behaviors probably a good 5 years before that were classified, you know, as like a steady slide down a cliff. And then for about 5 years, I just kind of fell off the cliff. So the real addiction lasted probably maybe 12, 13 years.
Wow. So when did you start like becoming addicted to it? Was it around, say, high school or college age?
No, actually, I was kind of a late bloomer with the addiction. I was a late bloomer with everything, actually. I was a big tennis player. I was a big tennis player growing up. And like my dream was to, you know, follow in the footsteps of Andre Agassi and be a professional tennis player. And that, I mean, I held on to that through college. I played tennis in college and then kept playing tennis a little bit after college. And then when the tennis went away, you know, the drinking and the partying, and I got a job at a bank, and that started to show up. But the thing about it was, is that all that tennis was such a priority to me that I never really let anything else in, like drinking or drugs or anything like that. I was really careful about it all through college. And then from after college until I was about 33, actually exactly when I was 33, you know, like I said, there was a steady slide down a cliff, but I held it together, held jobs, held relationships, no consequences like DUIs or jail time or hospital stays or anything like that. And then when I turned 33, that's when the precipitous fall happened. You know, it was just boom. All of a sudden I was faced with a DUI, a couple nights in jail, first trip to rehab. And so that started a 5-year kind of bouncing along the bottom of the barrel lifestyle of in and out of rehabs, in and out of AA, in and out of relationships, can't hold a job, all that stuff.
Yeah, so it just goes to show you that at any age, you're never out of the woods, so to speak, of potentially falling prey to addiction at, you know, any type of drug or alcohol. It can hit anybody anytime. Actually, an uncle of mine died over a decade ago, and he was really close with my family, but he was in his late 30s, I believe, maybe even 40 or 41 when he became addicted to, because especially, I mean, there's been a huge epidemic in America, especially in where I'm from, like Boston area.
Yep.
Painkillers and pain medication. Opioids. Huge, huge epidemic of this the last like decade or so. And he actually, that's how he got on it. And a lot of people, that's how they start with painkillers, OCs and Percocets and things like that. And then just from there, it goes on to progressively worse things and, you know, heroin, that type of thing. But that's how he got on it. And, you know, at any age, it can hit you. It doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, little personal note, my sister actually passed away from alcoholism last summer. And part of the reason that I think it got to that point with her is that it didn't look like mine. Like mine was am I allowed to swear?
Yeah. Okay. Definitely.
All right, cool. So my life was a complete shit show. Like there was no hiding it. I mean, I was falling off balconies, getting DUIs, 7 nights in jail. Like it was out. I mean, and there was no hiding it at all. But so my sister had the alcoholism, but she associated what alcoholism was with what I was going through with the cocaine addiction and all that. And because it didn't look like her, she never addressed it until it was too late.
Wow. So what happened to her, if you don't mind me asking?
All of a sudden she had a gastrointestinal hemorrhaging and her liver was surface of the liver. So
wow.
Yeah, I just got a call one morning that she had passed. She was about to turn 50. She was 49.
Shit.
And so I mean, the thing, like you were saying though, like there's no like template for addiction. Like it can show up in so many different ways.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear about that, man.
Thank you.
So do you think, and I asked this too, I've had other people who've overcome addiction in the past on the show, a few people, and oftentimes their story is fascinating, how they overcame it, the type of willpower, the determination, mm-hmm. when they finally put their foot down and decide that they're going to do it, you know, the steps that they take. It's incredible. There's a lot to be learned from that, from their story. And I think there's a lot to be learned from yours.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, is there something in the past? So this is often a question that I ask them. Is there something in your past and your background, or perhaps even your sister's background as well, that led you to having that at some point in your life? Because you said it came up later in your life. Normally for people, it's, you know, later childhood and as they start to get older in their teens. But do you think there was maybe something like a seed planted or some kind of insecurity or something that you didn't like about yourself that maybe came about later on, and this was the manifestation of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was really little, I was very, very sick as a kid with like asthma and food allergies being the two main things. So the asthma was like, first of all, what that did is it just implanted major fear in me. And that fear manifested in a lot of ways. But the first fear was like, where's my next breath coming from? You know, so there was no like sense of control in my life, because it was like, if I eat this, I might get an anaphylaxis, or if I go outside in the springtime, I might have a severe asthma attack and my lungs will shut off. Wow. So there was that level of fear. And then also it made me feel extremely separated and different from all my peers, you know? And so I would like, I would be, I'm from Vermont, so I'm also from the Northeast.
Oh, nice.
And, so, you know, there's a big, it's like farmland, it's farm country. So all the hay and all the pollen and all like this seasonal changes had a major effect on me, in a sense of like, you know, I was like moment to moment, like season to season, as far as like breathing or anything like that. So it created immense fear and immense social anxiety in me, because I felt so uncomfortable, you know, having that like in the back of my head all the time. If I was like at a party, you know, on a big grass field, I could very well just have an asthma attack. I was playing Little League one time, and I remember I was actually having a great game. I had like a double and I actually got a triple. The grass and the fields had just been cut. And so the last thing I remember is standing on third base and just getting super dizzy and like taking, like, just unable to catch my breath. And the next thing I know, I woke up in a tent in the hospital.
Wow.
like ET style. And I was like, I don't remember anything in between the standing on third base and the hospital. But, you know, that like having those experiences just creates so much, like, in as a child, you have no frame of reference for that. Like, you have no frame of, like, what is this? Like, what's going on? And so growing up, I had this, the social anxiety perpetuated all through, you know, grade school and then, like, through high school. And then after high school, I found, I went to college in North Carolina, and, you know, it's kind of when the alcohol started, and I was like, holy crap, like, I can, you know, I drank, and it's like, it's relief. You know, like, I fit in, and, like, people like me, and I'm having a good time, and the chicks, girls like me, and all these things I never experienced before, like, this level of comfort. So that was my kind of, like, and of course, at the time, I had no idea what was going on. I just thought it was cool to get drunk. But looking back, I can see that, like, there was definitely, it definitely played a role, because, you know, like, when I, like, all the times getting sober, that 5 or 6 year stretch, the one thing that kept taking me out, like, making me drink again, was that I was so uncomfortable not having that crutch, not having that facade or that alcohol veil over my head, because it meant that, like, you know, all that social anxiety that had been basically bottled up and covered up for years was now, like, at the forefront. And so I would oftentimes, like, on a date, or, like, I'd go out and say, not going to drink tonight. And then, you know, a couple hours later, I'm like, this is really uncomfortable. Like, I'm just going to drink. Yeah. So that anxiety was just, you know, like, it just gets so strong.
Yeah, I honestly think that that's probably the biggest thing that most people do, or most people feel, is, or that's the reason why most people drink, is because of that uncomfortableness, the social anxiety. And when you know, just having a couple of drinks loosens you up, it's like things are so much better. But at the same time, there's a cost for that. Nothing, you know, there's nothing free that you're going to get out of that. Is, you know, some people say there's no free lunches out there. Yeah, it's true. There's a cost to everything. I think in a lot of cases, if you can temper it, if you can take control of it, it's not a bad thing. And there are some actual health benefits that can go along with it in some regard, with, you know, anti-inflammatory type of things, and, you know, it's cardiovascular protective, all things like that, in very moderate doses. But man, you know, it's so tough for so many people to really just, you know, have one or two drinks when they go out. It's like, you know, One or two drinks is the leading into 3, 4, 5, and 10 drinks, and then, you know, shots, and on top of that. So it's ridiculous, man. For so many people, they can't do that. But I get it, and I get why people fall victim to that. What, do you still drink now, or is that just completely off the table?
I've been completely off the table for me. Yeah, been sober November 21st, 2012, so about 6.5 years.
Wow. Good for you, man. So how have you dealt with that then? But, you know, the whole social anxiety and going out and being a little uncomfortable. I mean, I'm sure it must have sucked the first few times you went out, maybe the first dozen times you went out when you didn't have that crutch. How have you dealt with that now that you don't drink at all?
So there's a couple things there. One is, it got to the point. So when I reached the end of my drinking, I was like, it really wasn't a choice for me. I mean, it was a choice in the sense, like, I can't do this anymore, but, like, I had said, I can't do this anymore 1,000 times before, but this time was like, it was the absolute end. Like, there was just no question about it in my mind that this is not the road I want to go down. Like, I can't continue to do this to my family. I can't continue to do this to myself. Like, I had nothing in my life except fear, anxiety, and depression. And, so for me, like, there was just no question that alcohol can never be a part of my life again. So I kind of switched immediately. I mean, I was in treatment for 9 months when I first got sober back in 2012, 2013. So that kind of gave me a nice cushion to kind of, like, learn about myself and adjust a little bit. But then I moved to San Francisco, and my normal MO is, let's go to the bars and meet people. So when I went to San Francisco, I was like, well, you know, like, I'm in this new city. Basically, I knew my sister. That was it. I didn't know anybody else. And so I kind of just said, fuck it. Like, I'm just going to do this. Like, I'm just going to go out and own it. I'm just going to go out and own that I don't drink. And, like, people are going to ask why, and I don't know how I'm going to answer that question, but I'm just going to be like, no, I'm just not drinking. And then, so when I did that, like, a few times, like, it didn't take much, because once you realize that other people really don't give a shit that much, like, they don't really care. As long as they have their drink in their hand, it's not they don't care about you. It's they just don't care that you're not drinking. Like, it's in the whole thing, that my whole thing around, because I'm an alcoholic, and I think that, therefore, I think that people that don't drink are weird. Like, I said it all my life. I was like, God, if I ever meet someone who doesn't drink, like, I'm going to be like, what's wrong with that guy? You know, like, and I was like, I had that mindset. But once that, of course, that all had to change. But when I would go to parties or go out to bars, like, I love going to bars and watching football and college football on Saturdays. And I started doing that. And I was just like, you know what? No, just people buying shots, like, no, thanks, I'm good. And they really don't, it's not like they, there's no big deal to them because they're not alcoholics, you know, and they don't, they just don't give a, as long as they have that drink in their hand, they really don't care if you're not drinking or not. And 9 out of 10 times, they're not even going to ask any questions. And if they do, that 10th person's like, oh my God, that's awesome. Good for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of like, I had to get out of my own head in a way. Like I had to change, not only like my mindset shifted like that, like the pain that I was going through at the end of my addiction shifted my whole mindset around like, I have to be willing now to do whatever it takes not to go back to that. It's not even like I need to get somewhere else. It's like, I can't go back to that. And so once I had that, then I kind of just went out and just, you know, it's like learning to ride a bike. You got to fall down a few times. And so I just said, you know what, I'm just going to go do this and whatever's going to happen is going to happen, but I'm not going to drink. And of course if you're getting triggered, you always have the option to leave. You know, it's not like, and that's one of the things about being sober is like, there's so much freedom. Like you don't, like with alcohol, you like, if you're out at a bar and you're drunk, like you have to depend on an Uber or a taxi or somebody or your group of friends. Like and I think most alcoholics, like if I'm sober, like I have the freedom to say like, you know what, this isn't fun anymore. I'm going to go home. And so if you have the two things that realizing that the people there don't really care that you're not drinking and that you have the freedom to change the situation at any moment, those two things can go a long way as far as being comfortable in that situation.
Yeah. I think, you know, it takes time for people to do that. It seems like it did for you just to get comfortable with it. But the biggest thing is just going forward and actually doing it. And like anything else, you know, the more you practice at it, the more you actually familiarize yourself with that experience, the better it's going to be. And, you know, the easier and more comfortable you're going to feel with it. Was there a rock bottom point though? I think I forgot to ask you that. Was there some rock bottom point that actually made you decide that, you know, this is it, you're going to finally put your foot down? Cause you said, you did mention a couple of times that there was a few times where you said, you know, I have to stop drinking. This is it. And then you still kept drinking, like, you know, like many people do, they kind of fall back into that. But was there something that what was the thing that finally made you decide that really is it?
Short answer is fear. Longer answer is that, so my first trip to rehab, I was like, you know, I actually thought, like, I had been through some knee, playing sports all my life. I had been through a couple of knee surgeries. And so I did rehab on my knee and my body to get back to playing sports. So I really had in my head this idea of rehab was like, okay, let's go fix this problem and come back and continue to do what we're doing. So that was my first thought about rehab. And when I got out of rehab, so my progression is like, you know, there might be a problem here, but it's just a couple bad nights. It's like one bad night. And then it would be like, you know, that progression happened of like every night was a bad night. And then so over the 6-year period of the first trip to rehab and then the last one, you know, I fought at denial, whatever you want to call it. But I was like, you know, I know I can control this. And part of that was because previously from ages, like you said, 15 to 30, you know, I had controlled it. I had like been able to go to work on Mondays, hold relationships, not get DUIs. So I had that, like, I should still be able to do that mentality. But once the addiction gets to the point where they always say one of the sayings in recovery is once a pickle becomes a cucumber, you can never be a pickle. I'm sorry. Once a cucumber becomes a pickle, you can never go back to being a cucumber again. Mm. And that's kind of the way it is with addiction. Like once you hit that threshold, it's done. So finally, I went to rehab in 2010. And I knew at that point that I needed to be sober. Like I was like, this is really causing problems. But still, there was 2 more years in there where, and one of the years, for those next 2 years, I spent a year kind of not being sober, 30 days, 60 days, whatever. And then the next year, I was sober for 11 months and then fell off the wagon for 2 months. And then this last time, it ended that I was living in North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina. And I had been drinking for 2 months, spent 7 nights in jail, trips to the hospital, lost my dog, my car. I lost my job, so I couldn't pay rent. I was moving out of my house the next day. So November 22nd, the 21st, I was actually supposed to move out of my house. And it was 4 a.m. on the 21st. And I was sitting there at my kitchen table. I had just been through this 2-month bender. My drug dealer broke into my house a week before and stolen my TV because I owed him money. And my dad had given me like $1,000 to pay the movers and do whatever I need to do to get out of the house by the date that we agreed on. And I spent all that money on drugs and alcohol over like a 4-day period.
Wow.
And so it was 4 a.m. and the movers were supposed to be there at 8 a.m. And I had, you know, maybe $15 in my bank account and a pile of cocaine and a bottle of rum sitting in front of me. And I just decided, I just right then, it just was like, I can't. First of all, my first thought was like, holy crap. Like, and the house had not been packed up at all. If you walked in, you'd be like, oh, somebody lives here. There was nothing had been packed up at all. So there was like, I was just overcome with this impending doom feeling, is a common term you hear. It's just the immense fear of the next day. Like I cannot do the next day. So I called 911 and just said, I need help. You need to take me in. And that was my best thinking at the time. Like, and that was it for me. That was the end. I was like, you know, I got some clothes on and 911 came and picked me up. The ambulance came and picked me up, took me to a psych ward for 7 days. And then I was off to rehab for 9 months. And, yeah, so I was just sitting there and it just kind of like all the past 6 years or even longer, like 15 years of this downward spiral just kind of like caught up with me. And I was tired. I was sick. I was depressed. I was scared shitless. Like all the stuff just kind of like hit me. Like it all became clear that like, this is not working out.
Was there one thing that was worse than the other? Was it the alcohol or was it the cocaine that was worse than the other? Or were they just equally bad?
Yeah. I mean, it always started with the alcohol. It would start with a couple of drinks. And then after you had a couple of drinks and you're like, oh, you know, it'd be nice right now, some cocaine. And so it was always that progression. So one never really came around without the other, but I would say that the alcohol was like, if I identify myself, I'm an alcoholic. People a lot of times separate addiction and alcoholism. At the base level, there's no difference, but you know, like I would say I'm an alcoholic. Like alcohol is the one that really took me down. Cause without alcohol, there wouldn't be any cocaine.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm just saying, but they always went together.
This episode is brought to you by Away. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/eliteman and use the promo code ELITEMAN during checkout. Is it possible to have a perfect suitcase? With my Away luggage, I think I found just that. Away uses high-quality materials while offering a much lower price compared to other brands by cutting out the middleman and selling directly to you. All of their suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, making it both incredibly durable but also very lightweight. The interior features a patent-pending compression system, helpful for overpackers like me. They also have 4 360-degree spinner wheels, which guarantee a smooth and versatile ride, and a TSA-approved combination lock built into the top of the bag to prevent theft. And lastly, and probably my favorite feature of all, is their charger that comes equipped with a suitcase that'll charge your cell phone, tablet, and any other USB device like my iPhone up to 5 times from a single charge. For people like me who always have their phone dying at the most inopportune times, this is fantastic. The Away suitcase is sleek, clean, lightweight, strong, and an overall must-have when I'm on the go. I absolutely love my Away suitcase. With free shipping to all 48 contiguous states, a lifetime warranty if anything ever breaks, and a 100-day trial period to test it out yourself, you have to take them up and get yourself an Away suitcase today. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/eliteman and use the promo code ELITEMAN during checkout. That's awaytravel.com/eliteman and the promo code ELITEMAN to get $20 off.
What would you say for people that are listening that are actually thinking that maybe they know someone or maybe even themselves? I doubt that there's many people that themselves listening, but I'm sure there's probably a couple, there's probably a few, but the people listening that maybe know somebody, what are some of the signs that that person actually does have a problem with alcohol and it's not just a regular, you know, occasional social drinker type of thing, but it's actually a really legitimate problem?
So, as far as like... First of all, you'll notice a huge difference between like the sober version and the drunk version of the person. And you'll see it like mannerisms, behaviors, words, like everyone, you know, like there's a big difference between someone, a normal person that goes out and gets drunk and kind of slurs their words, maybe stumbles around a little bit, and an alcoholic who will get like a glazed kind of like a zombie-ish kind of state to them. And they're in a blackout, and the alcohol, the addiction is taken over, and they have, at that point, they have zero control over what is going on in their head, in their brain. So with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like the community, food, self-care, all that stuff, like the top three, with an addict, the drug of choice, whether that's alcohol, cocaine, opiates, whatever, that immediately goes to the top of the food chain, like the top of that hierarchy of needs. Because according to in the addict brain, what happens is that becomes survival. It's your brain has now convinced you that in order to survive, we need to get alcohol, we need to get whatever we need to get. before we get food, before we get community. That's why so many alcoholics isolate. So if you notice someone that you're like someone that you're worried about, first of all, like a major shift between a sober and a drunk version of that person. Second of all is if they're isolating and drinking and kind of pulling away from conversations, like not just like in a face-to-face conversation, but like if you notice like they go kind of MIA for like 3 or 4 days at a time, you know, if you're texting with them and all of a sudden they just Friday night, they just drop off and don't come back till Monday, stuff like that means that what they're doing is their brain is telling them that, again, like to survive, we need to, first of all, keep everyone that's going to like call us out on this problem at a distance, because we don't need anybody getting in the way of our drinking right now. So what they do is they isolate in their house, or they'll go to like random bars. Like I used to go to just like bars kind of off the beaten path that I wouldn't know anybody, and I'll just make new friends there. So the major things are, is one is that change in behavior, and two is that you'll just notice them kind of drifting out of like the social circles and the conversations.
Is there a amount of drinking that you would say is questionable or too much at some point? Like if they're drinking 5-6 days out of the week or every single day, I mean, that seems like it would be, but is there a certain number?
You know, that kind of goes back to the thing we were talking about at the beginning, how there's no template for addiction. Like I'm talking to a client, I have a client right now, and he's one of those guys that he works from like 7 to 2 every day. And then 2:30, he's at the liquor store, and then 3 o'clock until whenever he passes out, he's drunk. For me, yeah, I mean, that's one form of it. For me though, my MO was a binge drinker. I was a binger. Like I could start like Monday through Friday, Saturday. It didn't matter the day, but if I started on say a Friday, chances are on Tuesday, I'm probably still going to be going. But when I finally like reach that wall on Tuesday, I'm probably going to sleep for 3 or 4 days, and I could be fine for 2 weeks not drinking. Like I could go and just do whatever. Like maybe that bender was bad enough that I probably need to take a little break. And then, you know, my problem was in that first drink. So a lot of people have the cravings and like the triggers and stuff like that, where they're in that cycle of drink every day or take shots before they go to work to settle their hands, or, you know, they need to keep a steady level of drunk throughout the day. There's so many different ways it can show up, but, you know, like so there's like the amount of drinks. Yeah. I mean, if you're getting past, I mean, I think the number's like, it's actually like 2 drinks per, like every time you drink, and it's like 6 per week is considered an alcohol problem. But I honestly don't think that's realistic. So like if you have most of my clients that need to stop drinking, they find, and I found too, that like 3 to 4 is kind of the number where it shifts from being like, okay, I feel good, I'm drunk, I'm in control. Once they get that 4th or 5th one in, it's like, you might as well have 10. Because there's at that point the inhibitions go down so low, and the alcoholic takes over, the alcoholic brain takes over, and you basically get a case of the fuckets. And like I said, I got the fuckets with like going out and socializing, and to get sober, you got to get the fuckets. There's 2 sides to that fucket equation. One is like fuck it the courage way, like the courage fucket, and there's one is like the giving up fucket. So if like at that 3 to 4, maybe 5 drink threshold is kind of where the scales tip. And people kind of get into like, you know, I was good. Like when I go out and have 3 drinks or 4 drinks, I can wake up the next morning, everything's fine. But if I have, you know, 5, I end up having 8 or 10, and then the next morning and the next day sucks.
Yeah, it's funny. There's there's no middle ground here. It's either just a little bit, you know, 1 or 2, or like you said, 10 or more, and it's like that. Fuck it.
That's the fuck it zone. Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy. But yeah, I mean, it is very interesting to see that how some people, how it differs in every person. Some people drink every day, and that's, you know, their addiction. That's the way they're addicted to it. And other people can go like you 2 weeks, and then you go on this crazy binge where it's like, you know, Friday to Tuesday, you're drinking crazy and, you know, just nonstop. But it's very interesting how that works in some people. And then, like you said, that, you know, those 2 weeks in between, you're basically just normal and fine. But those 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks later after that, it's like, you know, you're back to the crazy partying and all that, you know.
Start thinking in your head like, oh, maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe I can try that again. Yeah, maybe I'll stop on Saturday this time.
Yeah.
No. Never.
So, yeah, I mean, it is. I think it's interesting. It's also, I think it's interesting in a way, but it's also kind of complicates it for some people because they're listening now or they've heard other things, and they're wondering, or in their mind, they're justifying it like, you know, well, it doesn't really sound like my thing the way I drink, so it must not be me. You know, it must not be a problem for me.
Yeah. So yeah, that's exactly what I talked about with my sister, how like everyone, society in general has like this view of an alcoholic who lives under a bridge and pushes a shopping cart around full of blankets and a tent. And like this, that view of like an alcoholic has to be something like that. In reality, like for me, like one thing I can look back on now and notice is that like from the first time I ever drank, I never really suffered physical hangovers, so to speak. Like I was able to metabolize the alcohol really well. Like after a 5-day bender, you're not feeling so good. But the thing for me, and the thing that a lot of my clients and people that I've talked to recognize, is that there's the emotional hangover. Like it's not like you can go out and even if you don't have that many drinks and nothing really terrible happens, like you wake up the next morning, you're like, you know, I just didn't feel 100% like it's supposed to feel. Like I don't think something just feels off. You know, and I noticed that from the first time I drank. I was like, it actually scared me enough to that I kind of put drinking on the back burner at that point. I was like, you know, it just didn't really agree with me. Like, you know, maybe it was a little bit fun, but I didn't feel so good about what happened the next day. So there's like that kind of reaction to alcohol is because the alcoholic gene or the alcoholic trigger in the brain has been set off and the guilt and the shame set in. And that grows, that guilt, and that will keep a lot of people drunk too. Like, you know, like one reason I would go for 5 days is because I didn't want to deal with, you know, the hangover, that emotional hangover. I would just avoid it as long as I could until I could sleep for 3 days.
Yeah, I wonder if that has to do with, you know, just talking physiologically for a minute in the brain, if that has to do with the huge dopamine dump.
Oh, totally, man. Yeah.
Yeah. For, you know, you're on this high for a few days or whatever, a few hours all night and like a super high, and you just shoot your dopamine levels through the roof. And then like the next day, it's like, you know, you have nothing there for the next few days sometimes.
Like, you basically open up like the spigot for your serotonin and dopamine and just like let it all out. And then like, you know, your body just can't replenish it that fast.
Yeah. And so you mentioned a gene. Do you think this is all related to genes and that some people are, you know, infinitely more susceptible to be addicts than other people? Some people can drink and never have that problem.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely like I said, like when I look back, you know, my family, there's not much alcoholism in my family. You know, a lot of people will have like an alcoholic dad or alcoholic mom, maybe a grandfather or something like that. I didn't have really any of that. My dad's dad was an alcoholic, but I think I met him maybe one time when I was like 5. So I never had any kind of like influence of alcoholism, but there's definitely like the brain chemistry of an alcoholic is different. And, you know, I had like I talked about that emotional hangover, like people that are not alcoholics don't have that. They don't wake up the next morning and be like, God, like, I just don't feel good. Like they just wake up and like, it's a normal day, or like they'll be able to leave. Like they'll have like a drink and a half and like half a drink. Like, what are you doing? Why are you leaving that on the table? Like that's good. That's good alcohol there. You know, like you don't want to get a little more drunk. Like that's that thinking. It's the thinking of the alcoholic that is, if a little is good, more is better.
So, Sam, going back to what you mentioned before with spending 9 months in rehab, what were some of the things that you did in rehab that actually allowed you to finally kick this habit? And then thereafter, what was your life like afterwards to make sure you stayed on track?
So in rehab, it's really about willingness. And that's willingness, like it's willingness to one, to like stop drinking. I mean that once you, and I've often said, and I put this on social media a lot, is that the easiest part of getting sober is putting down the drink, because you know when you put down the drink, like now I have to go back and look at the social anxiety that I deal with, and I have to go look at the depression that I'm susceptible to, and I have to go look at not only that but like what is the, like why, like why, what, where's that fear? Like my fear, I have a fear of rejection, and I like it's because growing up, like the kids would pick on me for my breathing, and like I wasn't like the allergies and the asthma, like it's socially made me awkward enough that like, you know, I didn't do well with girls, and you know, my friends were like, I was kind of, you know, an outsider, so to speak. And so you got to look at like, how does that affect you? And then one thing that, and if you're willing, I mean, you got to like really look at that, because that's, if you, it's like building a house. So when you build a house, like you have to excavate the land, because there's all these rocks underneath the earth that will come up and like disrupt the foundation of the house if you don't clear them away. And you got to go, you know, whatever, 20 feet deep to find these rocks and clear them out, because that's what the earth does, is it pushes all these rocks up. That's the exact same thing. Like if you're building, like when you get sober, you're building a house, like you're building a new house for yourself. You're building a new person to live in, a new identity, a new life, all this stuff. And so if you have underlying rocks that are going to come up and disrupt your foundation, you're going to have it's going to ruin your house. Like you're going to be susceptible to that. You're still going to be susceptible to that anxiety and that depression. And I mean, I'll be completely frank with you right now. I just recently am going through something right now where I was triggered big time, not so much to drink, like that doesn't happen for me anymore, but depression, anxiety through the roof. And it was something that really made me look back at the situations growing up. Like, because I was never popular with girls, like, why do I have this reaction to heartbreak the way I do? To why can't I let go of certain things? And like, these things are things that now, being sober, like we talk about, like moving forward, like, you know, once you get sober and you do that work in the first year, you now have the experience and the ability to kind of pull from that and just say, the first thing is, no matter what, you're not going to drink. Like, I'm not going to drink because I know that if I was to drink, the behaviors would go completely off the rails. I would be, it would not make anything about anything. It would not make the pain go away. It would not make anything better at all. It would not make any relationship that I'm dealing with better. It would not make nothing could come of it. So the only option now is like, don't waste the pain. Like you're there's something going on that, and this is not the first time I've had this test. Like I've been through this before, and now, you know, having more than 5 years sober, like I think my head is clear enough to realize, like, okay, you know, this is one of those things where you've kind of suppressed it, and now it's back. What are you going to do about it? And so, if you want to look at alcoholism and getting sober the same way, like, you know, an alcoholic. Like I always said, when I first got sober, I was like, it started at 33. When I became an alcoholic. And that's not true. I became an alcoholic the first time I drank, when I woke up and realized like that didn't sit well with me. That was when, you know, of course, as like a 14-year-old, like you're not going to recognize, oh, I'm an alcoholic, I think I should go to AA. Like that's not going to happen. But you just become, you really, like once you've made that decision that drinking is done, you're done drinking, that's when like it's time to figure out why. And that's why like therapy or rehab or anything like that is super helpful. One thing going forward that keeps me on the right path is there's a lot of things, but remember the pain. Like I need to remember sitting there at 4 a.m. staring at that pile of cocaine and that bottle of rum and just being like, whoa. Like, this is not good. You know, that fear. Exercise is a huge part of it. Meditation is a huge part of it. Reading, I find a lot of like relief in reading, just like either self-help books or whatever. One of them I'm into now is called The Untethered Soul. And that's really, really great. Yeah, exactly. Yep. That's really, really great for dealing with, like he calls it the inner thorn. You know, you can build all these structures around that thorn to like, appear that like the thorn does not bothering you, but until you actually look at that thorn and just remove the thorn, it's still going to bother, it's still going to control your life. So all that kind of, anything you can do to deal with that. There's one thing I will say about, so rehab is great. I mean, if you get to the point where you need rehab, you need to get away. It's great. There's a big, one of the reasons I do what I do is because, one struggle I had, and I've seen a lot of people have, is that transition back into the reentry, so to speak, into the real world again, because you've been away for 30, 60 or 90 days doing all this work. And then you come back in and you know what, the baby's crying at 4 a.m. or, you know, you got to be at work at 9 a.m. Like, and you're like, wait a second. Like I just, I'm sober. Don't I get a pat on the back for that? Like it's just, it's a real hard reentry. So, If I could tell anybody like one thing about rehab, it's kind of like going, like a crash diet, what's that diet called? Where you do the injections. Anyways, it's like a 500 calorie a day diet. And you do it for 20 days, and then, you know, 90% of the people will just rebound and start eating all the things they used to eat because they're so hungry. Like, that's kind of what rehab is. Like, you need to be prepared to, when you get out, to, you know what you signed up for. Like, you signed up for work. You signed up to be sober. You signed up to do whatever it takes to be sober. And no matter what, you can't drink. But the second thing you have to do is remain willing to look at anything that comes up for you.
Yeah, I think, too, it can be a blessing in disguise, like a lot of things in life, a lot of afflictions, a lot of challenges, a lot of struggles. You know, once you overcome those types of things, you become a better person, better man, and much stronger. Like, it changes your perspective on life and what's really meaningful. We stop chasing all the materialistic things and chasing money and chasing the insecurities, you know, that hold us back, and just start living a more meaningful life where it's, you know, more purpose-driven and fulfilling. And it sounds like, Sam, that you've done that. What do you do with your clients specifically, though? I'm curious, the ones, first of all, how do you get your clients? How do you find these people? And then
what do you do with them? It's a social media age. It's Instagram, it's Facebook, it's LinkedIn. It's just putting the message out there, word of mouth, whatever you can do. I'm actually about to write a book about my, and I sent you the article that I wrote for Craig. I'm about to write a book, and just basically it's going to be use that as a kind of a template and outline and just expand on that. It's a lot of just putting yourself out there, and we like to call it recovering out loud. So, like, I am completely open about my recovery and my struggles, because I know that I'm not the only one that goes through any of these thoughts or any of these situations. So that's the main way to kind of attract the clients and stuff like that. But with my clients, so my program is it's pretty custom. It's three phases. There's the first phase I call it the heavy lifting phase, where we're going to look back at like all these things I talked about, like the childhood stuff, the childhood traumas, and whether that be, you know, a relationship with your parent or a high school girlfriend that broke your heart, whatever it is, like these things stick with you. And so we're going to take a look back at that and realize and figure out exactly what got you to today, like on the phone with me, talking to me, why'd you call me, just to that point. And that could be either, like I said, someone who is currently struggling with putting down the drink, or someone that has put down the drink, but they weren't ready to handle life that way. So the program applies to either one of those people. The second phase, the second part of the first phase, is now we go from here. Okay, where do you want to be in 6 months? Like, what about like this is not working for you, and what would be working for you ideally in 6 months? So we look at current situation and then ideal circumstances. And now we can sit down and theorize all day long about like, okay, so I want this to happen, this to happen, this to happen, this to happen, and then in 6 months I'll feel this way. The fact of the matter is that that's not how anything happens. So we can kind of do a roadmap, you know, very loose kind of roadmap, to say like, okay, these are the things you want to happen. Let's remain flexible, remain like water, so to speak, and just be able to course correct. So then the second phase of the program is all about the course corrections. So we've got in place where we want to be, and we've got in place the things we think are going to work. But let's stay in for the first two phases. There's calls twice a week, so we'll stay on track with, what's working, what's not working, anything that comes up along the way, how to handle it, stuff like that. Weekends, if they get like a work party or a golf trip with the guys, whatever coming up, give them some strategies about that. The third phase is taking the training wheels off. So that means it's the fourth month. It's a four-month program. The fourth month is that there's only two scheduled calls, and I give there's a third call in there if needed. But the two scheduled calls are one at the halfway point and one at the very end. But it's basically after 2 months of course correcting, we should be dialed in enough that we know what's working and what's getting us in the right direction. And then it's up to you. Like I said, training wheels off. Like, you go do your thing, and I'll talk to you in 2 weeks, and I'll talk to you in two more weeks if something really goes haywire, you know, give me a call and we can talk about it. But for the most part, you're on your own at this point.
It sounds, man, it sounds like you got that down pat, and you know, it sounds like you're helping a ton of people. What is like the success rate with people with that do this? And I'm sure, you know, it varies from person to person, and you know, across like different addictions and that type of thing. But when you have someone like you, in other words, when you have someone like you actually being there and supporting someone, being that mentor, being that teacher, that guider, how successful can people be when they actually try to quit something, an addiction?
That's kind of a loaded question, but kind of not really. So I think that it's a crazy stat, but overall, I think it's 4% of addicts actually get sober permanently, long-term sobriety. So that means that 96% of the people out there are struggling with long-term sobriety, and long-term meaning, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. The success rate when they become willing and they have guidance, this is why therapy, coaching is so important, is much, much higher. And I would love to sit here and say that I'm a miracle worker and I get people sober. It's, they have to be willing. Like the first question, the first three tenets, or so to speak, of my program are: you have to be honest with yourself, you have to be honest with me, and you have to remain coachable, which is short way of saying you have to be willing to do whatever the hell it takes to not pick up a drink ever again. So it really starts with them needing to be willing. And that's the trick about addiction, man. Like, you can talk to people, you can read all the books you want, you can have 8 coaches and 6 therapists and meditate an hour and a half a day, but if you still have a reservation about drinking or using drugs, nothing will help you. And, you know, having people to, if you're willing, but you're still lost and confused, but you know deep down, like, you need to stop drinking, and now I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm going to call a coach. I'm going to call a therapist. That will be a major benefit to you and increase your chance of success exponentially.
Sam, I love your story, man. I think you've done a great job yourself personally and just helping so many people out there. I wish you the best in continuing to do that. Just take a moment, Sam, just wrapping things up. Yep. Can you send a send-off takeaway message that our listeners can have, the Elite Man audience, and then also a place that they can check out your work?
Yes, for sure. One thing I will say is, first of all, that willingness, and that's in anything you do in life. I mean, sobriety, it's definitely applicable. But if you're not willing, one of the things I love to say is, if you're not ready for all of it, you're not ready for any of it. So be willing to do whatever it takes. Secondly is, there's a lot of lingering guilt and shame with alcoholics about their behavior, about how they treated people, about how they treated themselves. It's really important to know that, one, you're not a bad person trying to get good. You're a sick person trying to get better. And two, you need to have I like to call it the so what, now what approach. And this is what saved me a lot from my childhood and from the social anxiety and all that. Okay, so you know what? I was a sick kid. So what? Now what? Okay, I had social anxiety through high school and college. So what? Now what? I was an alcoholic in my late 20s, early 30s. So what? Now what? And that doesn't discredit any of it. What it does is it separates it into handleable, bite-sized things where you can address it separately. So, and that same thing, like, now that you're sober, like, so what? Now what? Doesn't say, like, to your wife or your girlfriend or your family, like, get over it. That's not what I'm saying. It's saying, so what, to yourself, that happened. What are you going to do about it now? Like, you know, like, life is like an airplane. Like, you can't land on the runway behind you. What are you going to do? Like, do the next thing, do the next right thing. So take that approach, I think, is really important. But, you know, willingness, and then the so what, now what.
Awesome. And what's the website you got?
Yeah, so the website is teloslifestyle.com, and telos is spelled TELOS, and then lifestyle.com. Instagram at teloslifestyle. I have a podcast. It's called Through the Fires. That's on iTunes, Spotify, all that stuff. And then I have a confidential phone line, which is 424-241-3710. If, you know, like you said, if you or someone you know is struggling, reach out any of those ways. I'm around. And I'm on Facebook too, just Sam Morris.
Awesome. Sam, thanks again, man, for coming on. Really appreciate it. And I know our guys are going to love this one. So take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Justin, man, it's a real pleasure to have to be on, and I'm really honored. Thank you very much.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.